Hello, and welcome back to another episode of our Nature-Based Solutions podcast series, where we explore how the natural world can help us tackle the climate and biodiversity crises. From Savills, I'm Nikki Whiteman, Director of Emerging Trends.
And I'm Alex Godfrey, Joint Head of Natural Capital.
The UK is one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. And despite nature struggling against all odds to survive, more than one in seven native species face extinction, and more than 40% are in decline. But these statistics from the WWF do not mean that all is lost for UK biodiversity.
In this episode, we hear from Dr. Samantha Lacey and Tom Ludwig on how they're helping to push biodiversity up the climate agenda. From diversifying your diet and letting your garden grow, to the revolutionary technology behind eDNA and how it can restore natural environments, Tom and Sam explain how we can reverse the tide of biodiversity loss and improve the health of our ecosystems. So Sam, Tom, thank you. Thank you for being with us today. It's really great to have you join us. Let's start with some of the basics here. As you know, this is pretty fresh space for me, and like so many people, I'm trying to understand it. Biodiversity feels like an enormous theme to begin to wrap your head around. Where do we start when we're talking about biodiversity? What are we thinking about?
So I think with biodiversity, you know, I think what people have realised recently is that it's not only an add-on to climate change, it underpins our response to climate change. And if all the services that nature provides include carbon, but go far beyond carbon. So if we think about flood protection, if we think about water cycle regulation, carbon capture, of course, soil stabilisation, erosion prevention, soil creation, and of course, all the things that we immediately associate with biodiversity, like the fluffy animals that we know and love. There is huge complexity in it. It's much more complex than carbon, but it's also more tangible for people, I think. So once you start talking to people about biodiversity, it's something they can immediately relate to. I think that's for me where it starts.
For me, we've come to think of climate and biodiversity in isolation, when in fact they are inextricably linked. So biodiversity is our regulation system, and when an ecosystem loses its capacity to function effectively, we end up with these more dramatic weather systems and less resilient habitats capable of recovery. And you know, you only need to turn on the news now to see this happening around the world. So I think, yeah, we need to think about biodiversity and climate as one and the same thing, and that they are incredibly reliant on one another.
Sam, you mentioned that in a way this is very much on people's radar now. Is it something, do people understand biodiversity perhaps better than, when we think about carbon, it can feel quite abstract for people who are not professionals in the space. Biodiversity might feel more tangible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it does feel more tangible, but I think it also, in some ways, because people have only just started recognizing how important it is and how much it underpins everything we do, I think it can also be a little bit overwhelming for people because it's so multifaceted and so complex. I think sometimes people get a bit overwhelmed by it. But that tangibility also means that if you are, as an actor, doing something about biodiversity, it's really good to engage with your clients or your stakeholders because it's so much more tangible.
I think we're in the intersection of the beginnings of being able to put a price on nature.
Well, I'm just going to jump right in there and just ask, is it right to put a price on nature? Is it right to put a price on clean water, clean air, species? Is that right?
Yeah, I think I have to be a pragmatist here. I do see the risks. I do understand why people are nervous about putting a monetary value on something that has such inherent value that you shouldn't, in theory, have to put a value on it. But the reality is, if you go back to basics, most decisions are taken based on financial drivers. And historically, all the services that nature has provided have been taken for granted. Now, for a while, that worked. While the impact of humans on the planet was relatively small, it didn't matter as much, or wasn't at least as noticeable, that we were taking all of those services for granted. But now human activity is the dominant force shaping our planet. So we can't afford not to value those services. because for each individual that, say, removes some woodland and increases the risk of flooding for everybody downstream to the river, you know, for that individual economic actor, that might make sense. But the net effect on the whole economy is devastating, because the services that that woodland or the mangrove or the coral reef or the grassland provide are so much more valuable than the economic gain that one individual actor gets from destroying that system. And so there has to be a way to incentivize that change. Now, historically, governments have incentivized change by introducing regulations, but regulations are only as good as the implementation and the enforcement of those regulations. And sticks can only go so far. They sort of stop people doing things, but they don't generate the kind of innovation and investment that we really need to turn this boat around and to start restoring and conserving nature rather than destroying it. The thing I like about putting a value on something is that you sort of unlock people's creativity of how they can restore things, and you sort of generate some momentum behind it rather than it just being a sort of a regulatory driver.
I mean, is there a danger in when we're thinking about this that I mean, you mentioned systems. Is there a danger that we're extrapolating out individual things within those systems, but we're not thinking sufficiently at a systems level? Is it, how do you value a system?
I think that's the difference between the extractive system that we have worked in, and Sam touched on it a little bit, the extractive nature of human business, and we took nature for granted, we just assumed it would always be there. The new business model, the new system, asks us to value nature and account for it. Therefore, how does it fit into the economic system? And rebuilding it, as Sam touched on, is more valuable than degrading it in this new system, because there's a value on it.
So I was going to approach the question from a slightly different angle, and I was going to start talking about, you know, what do we think of when we think of biodiversity, and what are we measuring and what are we valuing? And so you can think about biodiversity from the services that it provides. So carbon credits, in a sense, you know, they measure the carbon sequestered in a forest, replanting a forest system. So you can look at individual services provided by nature. You can look at individual species. So some people will take keystone species that are at the top of the food chain, for example, that can only exist if the rest of the system is in place. Or you can start to look at the whole system. And one of the things that I find really exciting about what Nature Metrics is doing is that because all living things leave traces of themselves in the environment in the form of DNA, we can measure all of it. And so rather than having to be limited by proxies and saying, oh, we've protected this area and we think that it's healthy because it's got this tree cover or because this species is there, we can actually measure the whole thing. And then what's also really exciting is that once you've got that big data on the system, you can start to use artificial intelligence to look at, well, what are the fingerprints of a healthy system? And you can, because you can take a big data approach, you can look at the whole thing rather than just looking at the very tiny pinnacle of the top predator that sits at the top of that system.
Because presumably, I mean, within a world where certain keystone species, for example, may be just well known or well regarded, it may be easy to think about that and important to think about that, where other elements of the system and biodiversity perhaps are just, you know, less appreciated.
Yes, and also, you only see the problem at the top of the house of cards when everything else has fallen apart beforehand. Whereas if you can monitor the whole system, you can see the changes much more quickly, because the changes will first impact the small things and then there's a sort of domino effect. But by being able to measure the whole tree of life, you can start to see all of the changes that are happening and see them on shorter timescales.
Maybe Tom, you can talk to us a little bit about the bottom of the pyramid, what's happening in our soils.
Well, I think up until this point, below ground biodiversity has been neglected. And we come to think of biodiversity as the big fluffy things that we all know and love. But actually, there's a huge amount of life below our feet that we're only just starting to discover. And so using eDNA, we can start to unravel that map of life.
I'm just going to stop you right there. Just explain to us, what is that, eDNA?
So eDNA is a shorthand for environmental DNA, and the easiest way to describe it is that every living thing leaves behind traces of itself in the environment, whether that's skin cells, hair follicles, blood, mucus, saliva, urine, feces, all of the above can be detected quite easily with simplistic sampling, and then we can run that through a lab, and through quite a rigorous scientific process we can identify the strands of DNA and match that against a database to provide an incredible resolution in terms of, you know, the species that are there and what types of animals are existing in a particular habitat.
How do we do better with biodiversity than we do with carbon? What have we learned from the carbon markets? That pros, what cons, what pitfalls? What have we learned that we can bring to the biodiversity market?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I worked in that space before joining Nature Metrics and kind of saw firsthand some of the unintended consequences of having this laser vision on carbon and not actually thinking more holistically about ecosystem function and habitat health. But I think one of the most pressing things that we need to do when it comes to generating biodiversity credits is aligning ourselves with a framework sooner rather than later. So we saw this with the soil carbon market, for example, and the voluntary carbon market around that created a lot of problems in terms of transparency or lack thereof, and different ways of calculating those credits. You know, is it carbon sequestered or emissions avoided? And it's only now that we're seeing certain frameworks starting to catch up, and things like the soil carbon code, for example, here in the UK. But then what we end up with is a system of kind of shoehorning projects to align with that framework and retrofitting. I think, yeah, the key takeaways are to get super clear on the methodology, align ourselves with a framework as quickly as possible, and create a system of transparency so that both sellers and buyers know exactly what it is that they're engaging in terms of that transaction.
I mean, I suppose, Tom, that brings us to that question of governance in this space. And Sam, you touched on regulation here. It appears, coming fresh to this space, that it does seem extremely unregulated, with very little governance, or at least governance with teeth. How does that need to change?
So, I mean, I think we're naturally at quite a nascent phase. I think biodiversity is coming hot on the heels of carbon and is accelerating in terms of implementation much more quickly than carbon did. And you're right, it can learn some lessons from the carbon market. So, of course, transparency. I think another thing I would mention is multi-stakeholder engagement. So particularly if you're doing some conservation or restoration of a biodiversity area, getting the local community involved, maybe involving them in measuring the biodiversity, which again is something that's quite easy to do with environmental DNA, because anybody can take the sample. So a multi-stakeholder approach. I think robust, verifiable outcome measurements. So I think as much as possible, we should avoid proxies and inferences and assuming what might happen, but actually measure what's really happening. Another thing I think is really interesting about biodiversity is because it's more tangible, because there's a natural story that goes along with the credit, I think it's more likely that those credits will remain traceable back to the actual project that they came from. Because I think if somebody buys a biodiversity credit, I think there's a natural story that you want to tell with that about the species that were protected or the area that was restored and what that looked like, which I think will really encourage that transparency, because they're not fungible. Biodiversity is not fungible. And therein lies the challenge that carbon doesn't have, that the biodiversity markets need to solve. With carbon, if you emit carbon in one part of the planet and you sequester it in another, it all sort of works its way out in the atmosphere. Protecting a hectare of forest in sort of southeast England is not the same, doesn't compensate directly for chopping down a hectare of forest somewhere in the Amazon. You know, they're totally different species. The impact that they have is, from a carbon perspective, fungible, but not from all the other ecosystem services that are provided into the local area. So I think that's a big challenge, and that's why biodiversity offsets are different from biodiversity credits. So biodiversity offsets are where somebody has had a negative impact, and they have to compensate for that. And that has to be done locally within the same ecosystem to ensure like-for-like replacement, whereas biodiversity credits are more about conserving and restoring nature rather than trying to sort of compensate for something else that's happened.
Sam, you mentioned government and not just using sticks. What is the role of policy here? What is the role of government, do you think?
That's a really interesting one. I mean, I think it would be, there are government schemes that are starting to mandate biodiversity offsets, so the biodiversity net gain legislation in the UK, for example, and there are similar ones elsewhere around the globe. And I think those are really important. I want to see the voluntary market mature as well, because I think sometimes they can be a bit faster and more nimble and more agile. But I think regulators have a role to play in making sure it's not a race to the bottom, that, you know, that there's robustness in there. But I mean, we're still at such an early phase with biodiversity credits. I think it's natural that there's a plethora of solutions right now of people trying to figure out, you know, are reduced insurance premiums or bond spreads the answer, or is it credits? Or, you know, I think there will be, and that's part of the innovation, that's part of what makes it so exciting, that at the moment there are a plethora of answers, but we will expect to see over the coming years that the people that hold these systems to account, the NGOs and so on, asking questions and weeding out the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, so that the ones that go forward into the next sort of decade are the strongest ones.
I guess my question in response is, do we have time for the market to sort this out? Is the market going to act quickly enough? I mean, Tom, Alex?
In the toolbox of solutions, policy is probably the biggest hammer in there. But historically, policy is the slowest moving out of them all. It procrastinates a lot. You know, we could stop global biodiversity loss tomorrow. We could stop climate change tomorrow through one stroke of a pen for policy. But it just won't happen because we are in a system that's multifactorial. The fast movers, the innovators, are the private sector. They're the startups like Nature Metrics. They're the people that are actually driving the market forward. But I think, as Sam touched on, there's so many different clever minds in the private market trying to solve the problem from different angles. You then end up with different frameworks, different ways of doing it. So it's finding that best in class and nurturing that in line with policy.
So I'm going to just push you on this, Tom. I'm going to be mean. I'm going to ask you this. I mean, is it just a distraction from actually doing what we need to do? You know, do we not need more policy, more regulation?
Well, I think if we take the British government as an example, they've been very good in recent years of setting quite ambitious, lofty goals around net zero. And just recently, actually, we've seen the government launch its blueprint on halting nature decline, and this was all off the back of commitments that were made at COP15, and we obviously have this 30 by 30 target. And, you know, there were a lot of positives to take from that. I think one of the ones that stood out to me was a goal to expand habitat for wildlife through 25 new or enlarged nature reserves, restoring river habitats, etc. So that's all good. It sets a target, something on the horizon for us all to aim towards. But yes, we have to rely on the private market to create the incentives and the structures by which to make that financially feasible. And so I think that's where sort of natural capital and being able to measure biodiversity uplift is going to play such an integral role.
I think global regulation needs to provide the private sector with the certainty that this is a good direction to go in, to that it's worth investing in, and that there will be markets. And I think the sort of noises that are coming out of COP15 and the direction of travel is now so clearly in the direction of biodiversity will be valued. We don't quite know how yet, but we do know that it will be valued and that it is important. And that's providing that kind of environment where the innovators and the leaders in the private sector are then taking that leap of faith of saying, right, I'm going to do this project. I'm going to take a strong baseline at the beginning because I'm not quite sure how this is going to have value in the future, but I know that it will. And so I think for me, the role of the politicians and the regulators is to, as quickly as possible, provide that sort of certainty and that structure so that the private sector has the confidence to make these investments.
Just touching back to the carbon markets and this kind of we have a big issue, we have some solutions and clever private institutions trying to figure it out. But there's different ways, as Tom highlighted, of measuring, say, soil carbon. That can be in-ground soil testing, that can be measure and model, measure and measure again. What's out there in the biodiversity space? What are the methodologies of reading this? eDNA is one of them.
Environmental DNA is one technique for measuring biodiversity, but it can be applied in lots of different ways. So, as I said before, you can use environmental DNA to detect your keystone species. So you can use it as an enhancement for traditional techniques where you might want to monitor keystone species, you might want to monitor their presence and absence across a landscape and how far their range is. And that's one way of using it. But you can also use it to measure the whole tree of life and to build metrics off that you can track over time. And you can use it to compare a degraded site to a healthy site and to track the sort of progress back towards a healthy ecosystem. So I think there's lots of different ways of applying it. What we're seeing is different schemes are using it in different ways. So we have one client that is using it to monitor keystone species in an area of rainforest that's being conserved. So because they have quite an intact ecosystem already, they can measure it and just monitor conservation of that system. We have other clients who are implementing restoration projects who are using, for example, measurement of the health and diversity of the insect population as a good indicator of the health of the overall system, because insects, you know, they will show change and the impact of both positive and negative actions more quickly than, say, vertebrates and mammals will. So there's lots of different ways of kind of taking the temperature, if you like, of the health of an ecosystem.
And what's really exciting for me, Alex, is that we're seeing this proliferation now of different techniques. So eDNA is one tool really in the toolbox, but there are other methodologies like bioacoustics, for example, which you can install listening devices into fields and pick up and detect certain pollinating species or birds, for example. We're also seeing more traditional methods like camera traps being installed in woodlands to detect some of those larger mammal species, so like the more iconic species that you might come to hope to see return in a particular habitat. So camera traps, bioacoustics are exciting, and then we're also seeing more geospatial drone technology being able to observe biodiversity from afar.
In our restoration rewilding projects that Savills have been doing up in Scotland, we've traditionally used an ecologist to walk around and spend quite a lot of time at quite a large expense to account for what nature is there. In terms of efficiencies, I'm sure you can talk to us about that and how eDNA can be more efficient than an ecologist. But what about from a cost perspective?
We've got numerous clients that have not wanted to shift immediately from the traditional techniques over to environmental DNA. And so many of them have run them side by side. And so we've actually got a lot of data from a large number of different projects of where they've been run head to head. And I'd hasten to add, I don't think environmental DNA is a complete replacement for ecologists. So for any ecologists listening, what we're trying to do is put an extra tool in your toolbox, not to put you out of a job. But what environmental DNA enables you to do is to, for anybody, whether they're an ecologist or not, to collect these vast amounts of data on the whole tree of life that then can be analysed by an ecologist to look for the trends and then focus effort. So if, for example, you do find an endangered species on site, your ecologist can then say, right, I know which part of the site I need to go and monitor that particular species in more detail now. I can focus my efforts where they're needed. And we've had instances all over the world where there's been sort of anecdotal evidence that there might be a really important species present, but nobody's known and they haven't been able to find them. And then you do an environmental DNA survey and you first confirm that, yes, it is present, but you can also say where. And then the ecologists have gone back in and found it. And so, you know, it's an extra tool that enables those ecologists to find things that they might have suspected were present, but, you know, they weren't able to uncover otherwise. And in terms of cost for the amount of data that you get, you know, it's a fraction of the time to collect it and a fraction of the cost but opens up a sort of vast amount more data.
Thanks, Sam. I think what you've really highlighted there to me is just the ability to monitor more biodiversity at scale. We all know there is not enough ecologists in the world to meet the demands that is now coming down the track to monitor biodiversity. So yeah, really interesting how that's a great tool in the toolbox to just measure more and more accurately.
Presumably, Sam, it sounds as though we're in this extraordinary situation where we know we're in crisis with biodiversity. We also know that we don't know, I suppose, a great deal about it. You know, from what you're describing, this sense that, you know, we're learning what exists as we're trying to save it, as some of it's being destroyed, a really challenging situation.
I'm reading a book at the moment about insect collapse, and the author compares it to a plane that's losing rivets as it's in mid-flight. You lose one rivet and you might not notice it so much, but you start losing multiple rivets all at once, then the plane starts to come tumbling down to earth. And I think the same can be said for the biodiversity crisis. It's something that's happening silently in the background. We're losing rivets here and there, and now we're starting to see the plane descend.
I'd like to pick up on that point around insects, because interestingly, the thing that really highlighted to people the insect population collapse, and I think I'm sure a lot of people know this, is that we weren't seeing them on our windscreens anymore. I mean, how is it possible? Like, people notice when giant pandas are in trouble because they're big and they're fluffy and they're iconic. But the insect population underpins, it's the small things that actually underpin the functioning of ecosystems. It's the insects in the soil, it's the fungi, it's the bacteria, and the things that we don't normally measure. And you're absolutely right, we have hardly any data on that. You know, the study that was done that showed that insect population collapse literally monitored number of insects on windscreens and number plates and looked at the decline over a decade. And for it to take that to highlight to us what a crisis we're in is shocking, really. So I think what's really exciting is that we can now start to measure this. But you're absolutely right, we're massively playing catch up.
I want to use the word humble in relation to the natural environment and biodiversity. I mean, it strikes me how very little we know.
So there are still a huge number of species that have yet to be detected. So particularly with below ground communities, soil fungi and soil bacteria in particular, we're still unravelling a huge amount of data to do with those types of those species. And yes, it is incredibly humbling. We know so little. And I think that's what's exciting but also challenging about our jobs, is we want quite quick and clear answers, but there's still so much to uncover.
What's really exciting is that we're now starting to come up with some metrics that simplify all of that complexity. Because yes, it's important to look at the whole tree of life. It's important to look at the little things, the bacteria, the fungi, the insects that underpin the functioning of the whole system. But if you give someone a list of names of bacteria, then, you know, they're not going to know what to do with it. And so what's really exciting is that we're starting to turn those into measures of diversity, both evolutionary diversity, functional diversity, and then it starts to become more tangible, and you can start to measure ecosystem health and how that's changing and how the system is becoming more diverse and more robust and more resilient as that diversity increases, when you switch from, say, a heavily chemically induced monoculture into a more natural system.
And what does that actually look like on the ground, Sam, in terms of KPIs, key performance index? You know, are you saying you have 10 times more aphids now and 10 times more predator insects and X amount of birds? Or and how quickly can you show with eDNA that change?
So let me take the second one first. So the speed of change does take a number of years, because there's no getting away from the fact that biology varies year by year anyway. And so it does take a number of years to really detect a genuine trend, because there will be fluctuations in the data. But the more data you measure, so the more of the tree of life you measure, the less noise you get. If you measure one single species, it will be very stochastic. You know, the data will go up and down a lot. Whereas if you're measuring the whole system, then the data is less noisy. And in terms of your first question around what does that look like in practice? So we're now building a dashboard with a number of different metrics that can be used for different purposes. But for example, you could measure the species richness. So how many species are in an area? If you imagine an area that's been grassland and it's being restored to woodland, particularly if it's been a monoculture and it's being restored into a more natural system, you can just look at the number of species increasing. That's a very simple measure. You could look at the evolutionary diversity of the species coming back, which again, it's just a single number, but you can track its increase over time. If you've got specific questions, like the health of a soil, for example, you can look at the fungal to bacterial ratio, which again, traditionally had to be measured in quite a complex way. But now we can also do that with environmental DNA whilst also collecting a whole load of other data. And you can even begin to unpack what functions the fungi and the bacteria are playing in the soil. And as you said about insects, you know, what's the diversity of the population of pests and predators and pollinators and so on. So you can create metrics around specific ecosystem functions, but also around just the diversity and resilience of the system as a whole.
And Sam, how quickly does biodiversity bounce back when you do change the system? I appreciate it. That's horses for courses. But or maybe Tom, you can talk to us in agricultural systems. You know, what happens when you stop spraying pesticides, fungicides, synthetic fertilizers on the land? How quickly does biodiversity come back? Does it come back? Does it stand a chance?
It does stand a chance, yeah, particularly invertebrate populations. You will see respond fairly quickly. Soil is a complex living organism with many different systems and processes involved. So as Sam said, you're tending to look for longer term trends in terms of soil response. But I think as long as you have a robust system of measurement in place and you have these metrics and KPIs to understand what it is that you're looking for, then I think that's the best way to sort of monitor improvement over time.
And are we seeing, is this in months, is it years?
I mean, it depends on the scale of the organism and also what's happening around the parcel of land that you're managing. So the rule of thumb is the smaller the organism that you're looking at, the faster it will respond, and on the smaller spatial scales. So, you know, bacteria and fungi might respond pretty quickly, invertebrates fairly quickly, vertebrates and mammal populations are going to take longer. So that would be one rule of thumb. And then the other is thinking about, well, what's going on around your land? If you've got a tens of hectares or hundreds of hectares and you're restoring that, then if you neighbour a national park, the chance for it to be for that diversity in the national park to spill over into your land is obviously much higher than if you're surrounded by, you know, farmers who are still using conventional methods and heavily spraying. And so you're like one little island in an ocean of monocultures.
We've not really talked about the relationship between the global north and the global south. It's a big question, I suppose. But Sam, I'll start with you. What's your thinking here? What is that interrelationship when we think through the biodiversity lens?
So one of the things I find really exciting about this space is that because in the global south there is more biodiversity and more biodiversity that needs to be protected. And one of the things that developing countries find so frustrating is that we've destroyed all our forests and they've still got a lot of theirs left. And the rest of the world is saying to them, please don't chop down your forests because, you know, we chopped ours down and we'd rather you didn't chop yours down. This provides a mechanism by which they can conserve their biodiversity and be paid for it. And we have one of our clients has a really exciting project working with some indigenous people who have struggled to be paid for their role in conserving tropical rainforests because they've done it for so long. You know, ironically, because they have always conserved that forest in the carbon markets, they can't be paid for that. Whereas our client is trying to build a mechanism where they get financial benefit for continuing to conserve the biodiversity in that system. And so I think it has the potential to provide at least a drop in the ocean of compensation for the role that that those countries play in conserving and maintaining biodiversity.
If you're listening to this and thinking, what can I as an individual do in this space? How can I be part of this building back biodiversity? What are some simple takeaways? What can we as individuals do here?
I think if you're a homeowner and you have a garden, then that's the obvious place to start, and it's by far the most tangible. I think if you have AstroTurf, rip it up and put down some real grass, and ideally don't put put weed killers on it so that it's a monoculture of just grass. You know, allow the weeds, see the beauty. I mean, in our lawn is almost no grass. There's clover, there's daisies. And I think one of the things that we need to start to do is to appreciate the beauty in wildflowers and start seeing them as wildflowers rather than weeds. So, you know, when the clover comes up in our lawn and you leave it, you don't cut it straight away with the lawnmower. Or the bees, your garden is covered in bees and pollinating insects. And so not mowing your lawn as much, not getting rid of all the weeds, you know, those kinds of things, and seeing the beauty in wildflowers and slightly wilder spaces, I think is something, it's a shift in perception.
I think if you can try and embrace diversity in your diet, that has a huge effect further up the supply chain. So we've seen, particularly in agriculture, the consolidation of a certain number of crops producing the most amounts of calories for our diet. And this has the effect that we have these monocrops and monocultures worldwide, and a lack of diversity in how our food's produced. However, if as a consumer you can demand more diversity and you embrace that in your diet, not only does that encourage growers to grow a broader range of crops, it also has the knock-on effect that you have a healthier diet and a healthier gut microbiome. So from a health perspective, it's a win-win as well.
Thank you for listening to our third podcast in the Nature-Based Solutions series. In our next episode, we take you on a journey into our woodlands with Sarah Lom of the Tree Council and Sabine Nouvet of the RSPB.
These are all really important conversations, so please remember to follow or subscribe to the Savills podcast. We really look forward to you joining us then.